You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaden Tokawingua, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. My name is Kaden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Pranuja. Ewha Akane coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to MP Shannon Halbert about rising fuel costs, the government's proposed pay rise for some primary teachers, and the Lawyers for Climate Action case against the government for dropping climate policies. I also spoke to Dr. Timothy Welch, Senior Lecturer at the University of Auckland, about rising fuel costs, New Zealand's dependency on petrol, and alternative ways of thinking about transport. For City Counselling this week, News Director Castor spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry about fuel insecurity and transport and energy alternatives for Auckland. Pranuja, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Professor Nirmal Nair from the Department of Electrical, Computer and Software Engineering at the University of Auckland on making the switch to electric vehicles. I also spoke with Dr. Murat Ungur from the Department of Economics at the University of Otago on how New Zealand can deal with the price at the pump.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pā tuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wae mai rane, give us a call in the studio on 309 3879. Ka au e wari wari iahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō. He pākehiri rukiruki mārunga i te pai tukutuku o Erirangi Pōho, mea haere ki 95BFM, erakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcasts on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309 3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Petrol prices have risen at least 20% since the start of the month, with the price of 91 petrol now above $3. This comes largely due to the US-Israel-Iran war, with Iran closing the Strait of Hormuz, which usually would have 20% of the world's oil consumption passing through it daily. The government has offered pay rises to primary teachers on individual employment agreements, undermining their current negotiations with the New Zealand Educational Institute. And Lawyers for Climate Action and Environmental Law Initiative are jointly taking a court case against the government for their dismantling of climate policies immediately after they were elected. The groups have accused the Climate Change Minister, Simon Watts, of failing to consult properly before changing the emissions reduction plan. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to MP Shannon Halbert about all of these topics. I started by asking if he was concerned about rising fuel prices.
I've been driving past petrol pumps on the daily while we've been in recess, and it's going one way and it's up. I'm hearing from families, even working families, that they're struggling to pay the costs of increased fuel. Yesterday I filled up my tank and it hit $170 for a very small car. So I can't imagine how that's impacting large families that need to get their kids from A to B.
Do you think there needs to be any restrictions on fuel use to curb this demand?
I think that everything needs to be on the table, because we can't see into the short or long-term future. This is really where we want to see some leadership from the government. They need to address the cost of living challenges here and now. They need to provide some respite to families and some reassurance that families won't be priced out of the market, essentially, that they'll still be able to fill up when and where they need to, or that there's other alternatives provided for them to get to work, for their kids to get to school.
Is there a world where, as a response to the fuel shortage, we double down on climate and environmental policy?
I hope so, but what we know is that this government has taken us incredibly far backwards when it comes to responding to lowering emissions and the needs of our climate. it's important that at this particular time that we look to, for Aucklanders, that we look to public transport as a reliable and more cost-effective alternative. But as we know also, those prices have increased under the watch of this government, and so it's time for them to seriously look at the funding that they put into Auckland Transport and ensuring that people can use the bus as a more cost-effective alternative.
And I want to switch now to ask about primary teachers. Are you supportive of the government offering pay rises to teachers on individual employment agreements?
I find this incredibly divisive from the government and from Minister Erica Stanford. I have spent a lot of time with NZEI, with the teachers' union, in their collective lobbying to increase wages for teachers to be recognised and paid for what they are worth. For the government to then come out through the back door and offer individual contracts is, you know, taking away from the focus that collectively as New Zealand, as a government, that we value teachers and we want to make sure that every teacher is paid what they're worth.
Is this undermining collective bargaining and unions?
Absolutely. I think it's absolutely. I think it's incredibly in bad faith. I've seen Minister Stanford time and time again and her government really take an axe to unions, and this is another attempt. NZDI has worked hard to represent teachers, and in turn it's teachers that teach our tamariki in schools that provide them with the best opportunities, and so I don't understand why Minister Stanford dislikes the unions and in fact is trying to get rid of them.
Do you support the NZDI taking legal action over this issue?
I support NZDI doing what they need to in order to have a fair run and to be heard fairly about how they can increase teachers' pay. We know that we're in a tight fiscal environment and some of those decisions will be challenging. But once you start peeling off individual contracts for teachers, you're always going to equate to a savings for government because you're never going to get a lift in pay for the collective.
And are you supportive of the Lawyers for Climate Action case against the government for dropping climate policies?
Given this is before the courts, it's a bit difficult to have an extensive view on it. But what I can say is that Christopher Luxon's government has taken New Zealand backwards on climate action. They're backing fossil fuels over clean energy, which has driven power bills up. And so this really impacts on the cost of living. It impacts on the number of emissions for New Zealand. We had good policies in place that saw a decline in emissions. And that's where we've got to get back to and potentially accelerate that. But this government is out of touch when it comes to responding to climate change.
The group says the government's climate plan relies too heavily on planting trees to offset emissions rather than actually reducing them. Would you agree with this assessment?
Well, I think it's important because we know by international, you know, that our international commitments is to invest here at home. And part of it is that, but we've also got to cut energy costs in order to boost our economy. But again, I go back to the point, this is a government that has taken us backwards on responding to climate change issues. I applaud the group for taking legal action because they don't feel heard, and this government continues to ignore communities that are saying that we need to lower our emissions and that we need to respond to climate change.
Is reinstating stronger climate policy a priority for Labor?
Yes, it will be. Later on in the year, when we've finalised our policy commitments, we will announce those. But myself, caucus members in the party, climate, our environment, conservation are important to all of us. We know that we have to protect our taiao and our future planet, and it now is the time in order to do that.
That was Labor MP Shannon Halbert on rising fuel costs, the government's proposed pay rise for some primary teachers, and the Lawyers for Climate Action case against the government for dropping climate policies.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father. City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Given rising fuel prices, Auckland Council has been under pressure to provide support for those struggling and invest in infrastructure to ensure the city does not face similar crises in the future. Despite these pressures, Auckland Council is hamstrung, stuck between rising costs of fuel and limited funding without central government support. To discuss what support Auckland Council can provide for City Counselling this week, News Director Castor spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry.
I wanted to start off with the rising fuel prices we've been seeing across the country. Been posing some difficulties for people, especially across Auckland, which has a lot of people commuting in by car every day. Is Council looking into any support at the moment?
Yeah, so we've had some discussions, initial discussions, some of us with the Chief Executive, with the Mayor, about are there some measures that we could take. There's a couple of different things. Well, one is the fact that we employ, as a council, directly or indirectly, thousands and thousands of people. So what can we do for our own workers and contractors? But also, obviously, what can we do for the population at large? And so there's some discussion about public transport in particular, that a lot of us would really love to be able to reduce the cost of public transport. But in order to do that, we need central government support, because in the past, so people will remember in the past, there was, half price fares for children, and the COVID times, there was all sorts of discount arrangements and free public transport for parts of it and stuff. But the funding for that came from central government. Council doesn't have the ability to fund much of that itself. And a lot of that is to do with the way that the funding for public transport works and how we are required by central government to meet certain targets about how much revenue we bring in from public transport fares. It's called fare box recovery. And Auckland actually has, in my opinion, ridiculously high percentage of fare box recovery that we're expected to do by the current government. And unless they agree to lowering those targets and give us some funding for the subsidies, we actually can't on our own give those discounts. Students will be aware that recently a 40% discount was put in place for students. That's a relatively small part of the total public transport fare intake, so we were able to accommodate that, and obviously that was a result of some amazing lobbying and efforts, particularly by your Students' Association over a period of time and stuff like that. But to put in place larger scale discounts needs central government buy-in. So far they haven't indicated that they're interested in doing that, which is disappointing, but we will keep up that conversation, yeah. The other thing is that obviously we've been preparing for some time to decarbonise elements of what council does to reduce the risk of shocks like this, but primarily to reduce our carbon emissions. And so, for example, we've already transitioned a lot of our fleet in terms of like our pool cars that council staff use and stuff like that to electric. We've had a program of replacing the incinerators that into systems that don't burn as much carbon. Our pools, the heating systems that they use, transitioning them to electric. So there's things like that we've been doing, which put us in a not too bad position. We haven't by any means finished that transition, but that hopefully will help a little bit, and then we don't have to put prices up to reflect an increase in energy prices to run those things, yeah.
And alongside buses and trains, public transport stuff, does Auckland have any other alternative transport options for people who are maybe looking to use something other than their car?
Yes, obviously we have been working on what's called active transport. So in particular for those coming longer distances, cycling infrastructure. I myself ride an e-bike, which gets me around. My son, who just started uni, he's using an e-bike to get in and out, and I'm very grateful for that, because you know, it gives us both flexibility. But we've found it harder and harder to invest in cycling infrastructure. Again, central government has changed the funding for that in ways that have made it really difficult. And I completely understand that a lot of people don't necessarily feel safe cycling on streets that don't have separated cycle lanes and things like that. I myself was hit by a car last year while riding to work. So but see, all of this is stuff that we needed to do before this crisis hit, right? And so I think I just would like people to remember in the coming years and in our budget consultations and stuff, this kind of infrastructure is not stuff we can build, turn on a dime and build in a hurry when a crisis hits. We actually need to get ahead of it and have pipelines and programs and long-term investment to actually build these networks to give people viable choices and alternatives so that they don't have to rely on petrol cars, basically. So, I would also say there's increasingly now opportunities to hire and try out e-bikes. So if that's something people are interested in, check in with your local bike hub. There's lots of bike burb groups as well, so for particular suburbs. Electric bike team, if you've got a bit spare, you might want to look at the maths on whether it's cheaper for you to hire a bike from them for a while than drive your car. And they'll let you do little test rides. You even get to do test rides, I should say. You get to do them on the pink path. That's how we picked my son's e-bike. So there's that option as well in the short term, that there are actually ways of getting a chance to try an e-bike. And, of course, normal push bikes, as my dad would have called them, they're even easier to access, albeit more difficult for people coming from further away, take longer, require a lot more energy, and,
You preempted my next question a bit there, but I wanted to talk about if this issue continues, or if it's over in let's say a week's time, are there any big takeaways that council is going to have, and are there going to be any things that you think we'll be pushing for in that next plan to increase our resilience in the face of a future issue like this, or if this issue continues?
Well, I would hope that my colleagues who perhaps haven't been as supportive in the past of decarbonising what council does and supporting others to decarbonise through, you know, programs like a rollout of cycleways and things like that, would take this crisis as a bit of a wake up and go, you know what, it might be over in a week or two, but actually this is the continuation of a long, slow burning crisis. And I don't mean to say, pun unintended on the slow burning there, you know, the price of petrol has been increasing for years and years and years. It's just it usually doesn't increase so quickly. And we just absolutely have to decarbonise. One of the key things that I've picked up in the last 2 weeks has been that although we have a high amount of renewable energy production for electricity, so 80-90% of our electricity is from renewable sources, mainly hydro. Because of our transport stuff in particular, but other parts of the economy too, still relying on petrol, only 30% of our energy needs are actually being met by electricity. So we can provide the renewable electricity, but if we don't have electric vehicles, if we don't have solar panels that click into our lighting that is run by electricity, you know, if we don't have these sort of systems where we're shifting things from relying on petrol to run to being able to rely on electricity, we won't make the shift that we need to on reducing carbon emissions and reducing our reliance on petrol. There's been a lot of misunderstanding about, so the Marsden Point refinery. We don't really make any oil in New Zealand. A lot of our reliance on sources of gas comes from overseas as well. All that refinery was doing was literally refining stuff that came from overseas. So even if we can still access petrol, it still has to come here on ships and be refined. And even if there's plenty of petrol available, the climate risk to things that come here by ship is increasing all the time as well. So we just, there's just so many reasons why we need to do this. We need to shift from relying on petrol to a reliance on electricity for more of our energy needs.
That was News Director Castor speaking to Auckland Councillor Julie Ferry about fuel insecurity and what Auckland Council is doing to both react to this crisis and prepare for similar crises in the future.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat. Text in your thoughts, 5395.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Chiba Chiba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
The Datsuns are back in action and revving up to ride into Auckland City and bring the noise. And your good mates at 95BFM have tickets to give away to some of you gorgeous, beautiful, lovely B-card holders out there. Just listen to Breakfast all week for your cue to enter. The Datsuns, Sunday, March 21st at the Hollywood Avondale. Get your tickets from Under the Radar.
He finally asked me out. He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday, only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
Hey, you might want to sort that Muppet out.
What's wrong with my Muppet?
Well, Sarah's going to be here on Saturday.
Sarah's coming? You didn't tell me Sarah was coming. She can't see this dreary Muppet.
Yeah, those bass lines are drooping as well.
Ah!
Fluff your Muppets and slip slop slap up your bass lines. It's Saturday afternoons with Sarah.
Sarah.
Saturday Afternoons with Sarah, 2 to 4pm every Saturday, only on 95BFM, thanks to Decibel Wines.
Doesn't give my opponents much time to run up to an election, does it?
The Wire.
20% of the world's oil supply has been shut off over the past week due to Iran's effective closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Petrol prices have reached $3 a litre, with some stations running out of fuel due to demand. New Zealand imports all of our petrol, diesel and jet fuel, making us especially vulnerable to global oil crises. We are particularly dependent on oil for transport, with electricity accounting for just 0.5% of domestic transport energy. Instead of focusing on alternatives to petrol dependency in transport, government funding has been withdrawn from public transport and electric car incentives in favour of new roading projects. I spoke to Dr. Timothy Welch, senior lecturer at the University of Auckland and an expert in transportation and infrastructure, about how New Zealand can move away from car dependency and our reliance on foreign oil imports. I started by asking if he could provide some context about what's happening, specifically why oil prices are suddenly rising.
Yeah, so we've seen oil prices kind of going up quite a bit over the years, but the sudden spike in prices are directly attributable to kind of the action happening in Iran. So the U.S. attacks on Iran have threatened oil supplies and kind of retaliation or threats of retaliation on the Strait of Hormuz and other oil production facilities means that a lot of the supply that we depend on is threatened or potentially uncertain. We don't know when it will get it. And the fact that we don't refine any oil within our own borders means that we're kind of reliant on all the oil shifting through the Mideast and through other countries, which adds a lot more pressure and uncertainty to oil prices and futures.
New Zealand gets the vast majority of its electricity from renewable sources. So why is this such a big issue for us?
Yeah, I mean, on average, our electricity is 85% from renewable sources, but we've hit over 96% at times. So massive amounts come from everything that's not petrol, not oil. But 40% of our energy consumption in this country, it comes in the form of burning fossil fuels for transportation. So while our houses and businesses and factories are powered by renewable sources, everything on the road, well, not everything, but a huge majority of things on the road are still powered by petrol, which means we still have a huge reliance on fossil fuels.
Do policies like the clean car discount work to solve this issue of car dependency?
Clean car discount had a number of limitations, and there are a lot of valid criticisms around it and ways that we could have spent money potentially more effectively on other things. But at the end of the day, one of the things it definitely did is increase the number of EVs in the country. We don't have any domestic production of vehicles, especially electric vehicles, in New Zealand. So we have to kind of offer a lot of incentives to bring them in affordably. And while, you know, people argue that the discount did apply predominantly to higher income people, the fact is that our EV fleet grew by over 50% per year during the discount period, and then shrank down considerably to just about 10% of the fleet after the discount ended. So it was effective in creating a market for EVs and bringing many more electric vehicles into the country.
Does more also need to be done to encourage public transport use, and what can be done in this area?
Yes, I mean, one of the big things that will naturally drive public transport use is increased prices at the pump. People will start to do the math, and public transport will be usually a clear winner in terms of the cost on a daily basis. But we can do a lot more. We used to have much higher discounts for youth under 25. We had, free fare days often. We had half-price fares. All of those things provided large boosts to total public transport ridership, and a lot of those things we've gotten rid of. So we could kind of go back to some of those policies and make it more affordable to use public transport and take a lot of pressure off of our petrol supply and off of our roads in general.
On that topic, I want to zoom out for a second. Do you see this as an opportunity to reimagine our entire transport infrastructure, maybe to make us less dependent on foreign oil supplies?
Ideally, this is something we would really take seriously and say this isn't just another, you know, it's a temporary period of pain that we have to pay for, but this may be a radical shift in the way we view our transportation system. More cynically, though, if we look at kind of our historic response to changes in oil prices, we'll try to do whatever we can to drop those prices and wait for them to drop on a global market and go back to the way we are doing things. But ideally, yes, we would certainly reconsider our entire transportation system and try more seriously to wean ourselves off of foreign oil as the major driver of our transport system.
What needs to change to make this kind of thing happen? Is it purely a mindset shift, or is there huge spending required?
You know, there's less spending than we would expect to make a real shift into things like public transport, cycling, and walking a reality. A lot of the infrastructure we need for better public transportation is there. But what we need is faster, more reliable public transport. We need more buses on the road. We need more reliable schedules. We need them to come at a time where you don't have to look up a schedule and wait for the bus. It just comes on time, or a train comes quickly. Those sort of things can happen very quickly. We need better cycling infrastructure, safer cycling infrastructure. That's a lot cheaper to build than it is to build a road. And if we have that infrastructure, we can encourage more people to use public transport, to use cycling and walking as a real alternative to driving. So it's not just a mindset, but it's creating the opportunities for people to use these other modes first. And if we do that, then people will naturally kind of shift to these more reliable, more affordable modes rather quickly.
And I want to end just asking about one other possibility. Other places are implementing strict fuel-saving measures. Sri Lanka, for example, has made every Wednesday a public holiday so people aren't doing their daily commute or using fuel in that way. Do you see policies like this on the horizon for New Zealand?
It's possible. We've tried this sort of thing before. To much criticism, but you know the numbers show that it was rather somewhat effective at reducing demand. But these are just temporary stopgaps. So we've done this. Other countries have done this in the 1970s when the OPEC was holding back supplies as well, and prices shot up then and supply dropped. But these are all just temporary measures. If we want to be serious about this and kind of make ourselves more immune to oil price shocks, then we need something long-term. We need a way of providing people an alternative for a long period of time, not just over a few weeks or months, but over their work life, over their daily lives, to be able to get out of the car and use other modes and not depend on filling up every week or every few days at the pump. So the rationing can help in the short term, but long term, we really need to make significant changes to our entire transportation system.
That was Dr. Timothy Welch, Senior Lecturer at the University of Auckland, on rising fuel costs, New Zealand's dependency on petrol, and alternative ways of thinking about transport.
That's probably slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire.
There's growing conversation around whether electric vehicles could offer a more stable, cost-effective alternative to petrol cars. But while EVs are often positioned as the future of transport, questions remain about whether New Zealand's infrastructure and electricity system are ready to support the widespread adoption. I spoke with Professor Nirmal Nair, an expert in energy systems and renewable integration from the University of Auckland, about what rising fuel prices mean for New Zealand, whether EVs are a realistic alternative, and if our grid is ready for the transition.
In your recent comments, you say fuel price volatility is exposing how dependent New Zealand is on imported fossil fuels. How vulnerable does that leave us in moments like these?
Well, the vulnerability can be decided based on how much days we have before rationing starts. So there's always, each country have their different levels, of security. So currently we are in level one. So those levels depend upon how much of a stockpile we have already. And I think we have about 35 days or something like that at the top of my head. So different countries have different things, right? So so if you don't have fuel, right, so which is, we are talking about petrol, gas, all the other derivatives, so, which are transport fleet depends on, then we are vulnerable, right? But it's not only us, but all other parts of the world as well. So we still have time, but these times we are vulnerable. So how the country manages is, initially there will be a price hike, right? The retail price hike. So people are more efficient and things like that. But if it goes beyond that, then, that'd be rationing, right? And so that stage has not come yet, but if the supply crisis continues for, let's say, another 2 or 3 months, then we would have to start looking at it, right, and start utilizing whatever our spare strategic capacity is.
You describe electrifying transport as one of the most effective ways to cut emissions and reduce costs. How achievable is that switch for everyday New Zealanders right now?
Well, if you want to make a switch, yes, you can do it immediately right now. There are still, currently there are 3% of passenger vehicles, which is about 2 million, something like that, currently, who own an electric vehicle, right? So it's easy to purchase it and buy it, right? So from an emission viewpoint, that would be, you won't have to spend petrol or diesel, right, for your vehicle, passenger vehicle. So 3% of, the car owners here currently have EV, so that switch is possible. The cost part is the running cost I was talking about, right? Not the investment cost, right? So so that would be the price of electricity, right? And so that is much cheaper to run compared to, purchasing petrol and diesel to run it.
Only around 3.5% of New Zealand's vehicle fleet is electric compared to 30% in, say, Norway. What's holding us back?
It's not only holding us back, it's holding the rest of the world back, right? So this is considered, electric vehicle was the first use case of electrification, way back in 1920 when electricity was first kind of established somewhere around the 1880s. So the first use case for electricity was actually electric vehicles way back in 1920. Right. So, but then that discontinued because we had internal combustion engine, and everyone went for petrol, gas, and things like that. And that's history, right? Now we are looking back again at that option back again. So already existing, passenger vehicles, we already have, all of us have it, right? In terms of internal combustion engine. So then that means we consider today in 2026 this as a new technology, while electric vehicle was a very old technology, right? But we currently have that. So that switching is taking the inertia off. So in innovation, we call it as an S-curve. So the S-curve is basically, there is a minimum threshold after which it becomes commonplace and everyone would want to own an electric vehicle, right? So Norwegians have thought about that for a long time. And since 1990s, they have had policies. So they must have been very low uptake of electric vehicle in Norway way back in 1990s, right? So this 30% number is currently there in Norway right now, right? So so that's what I was comparing Norway with New Zealand, right? So we have the electric vehicle, we have that. Most of our passenger vehicles are imported anyway, right? Even the internal combustion engine, right? Everything is imported. So theoretically, we have to make a choice whether we want to, are we really meaning what we are talking about, and do we want to switch, right? And if we can do it, so that's holding us back. What's holding back us is us. Right. So that's why in that article I told, do you want to make a choice, right, as New Zealanders? So nothing's stopping us from doing it. Right. But then, of course, we'll have to worry about other things, who's going to pay the money and things like that and so on and so forth. So that's just the general inertia of, the S curve. Right. So we can go from 3% to 30%. That's not a problem at all. But again, it depends on whether we as a country are ready to do it.
How prepared is New Zealand's electricity system for widespread electric vehicle adoption?
Well, we are geared for it. Again, electricity in New Zealand is as old as 1880s, right? So currently, we are powering homes, we are powering all the new devices and things like that. So, and we are only 3% anyway, right? So hypothetically, if you say, 50% of all our electric vehicles are suddenly penetrated, then even then we might consume, let's say, top of my head, 5% more electricity. So our electricity system is geared for that anyway. So that's not a problem, right? So it will be one additional load, right? And that can handle it. So, and we will be building up the grid, strengthening the grid, and so on to build it up. So from an electricity viewpoint, it's not a big issue. So a grid issue, but of course it has to be well signaled. We have to do, we have to put some fast chargers and things like that. And currently you can charge your electric vehicle slowly from your home as well, right? So nothing new, it's just like connecting a new device.
You mentioned that electricity pricing and when people charge will become important. Can you explain how that might affect households?
So currently, so first I'll talk about the charging thing, right? So the just like if you go to a pump, what do you really do? You go and pump your gas up. Most of us do. Some might fill half a, you know, half a tank or something like that, right? So that we are used to filling up our petrol tank to the full, right? So if we try to do that with an electric vehicle, we can do that. But then if all, usually, you know, humans, they go back home. Usually the charging time would be the night time, right? Because your electric vehicle would be parked in your garage or something like that. Your neighbors would be doing exactly the same thing. All of us would be sleeping at night. So currently everything would be charging, right? So that needs to be coordinated somehow, because if you don't coordinate it, we have built all the electrification based on a certain load. So that's what I was talking about, right? We need to manage the charging amongst them, you know, neighborhood during the nighttime if you really want, right? So that would be one part of that exercise. You could do that with prices, for example, because as you know, currently, even without electric vehicles, some places they have free nighttime charging and things like that. Students, you know, in dorms and things like that. I do know some of the utilities pay, you know, Thursday or something like that, time of period where they give free electricity and things like that. So we might need to try out some innovative charging mechanisms so that we don't overload the local grid, right? So that's what I was talking about, the charge. And price can be used to kind of incentivize that. When do you charge and so on and so forth? Try to make it a little bit more expensive in the night so other people who cannot manage that can charge during other times of the day. So actually spread out the electric vehicle charging load. That's what I was trying to imagine in my mind when I quoted that statement.
How important is it for New Zealand to transition to a low-carbon transport system?
We have signed up for the policy. You know, New Zealanders like to claim themselves, you know, so we are clean and green and things like that, right? And we want to be good citizens, global citizens. So if we collectively choose, you know, that we would be slowly in the next 10 years or 20 years or 30 years come out of, you know, internal combustion engine fuels like petrol and diesel, at least for the passenger cars, then we have a chance, right? So because we can't preach to the world, right, when we can't ourselves do it. So it really depends upon, we have to compare ourselves with countries which have gone that pathway. Just like Norway is one example, but I can give you a couple of other examples as well. So it depends on whether we want to change or not, right? If not, we have to have a reality check, all right? And currently we are worried about, you know, the petrol prices and things like that. And we are really worried about supply shocks with petrol actually reach New Zealand. So this is the right time to start thinking about this. So slowly we need to wean away from this. And we have signed up the Zero Carbon Act in 2019 anyway, right? And we have policy statements and things like that. So policies are just giving some nudge to people to change their behavior. And we are aspiring to be zero carbon by 2050, I believe. So we have 24 years. So this might be the right time to start this journey, right?
For anyone listening that's thinking about switching to an electric vehicle, what's the key thing they should consider?
So currently, if they're wanting to switch, obviously you might have to purchase, right? So currently, so supply issue is an aspect. So you should look at what the market is. Many companies have now started having their own fleets. You know, the German, the European companies having a lot of fleet associated with that. There are some American companies. Of course, Tesla is well known, but there's a whole bunch of Chinese companies as well, and now Japanese vehicles and Korean vehicles. There are, you know, those options. So a couple of things to note. So if you're interested in purchasing, you know, start looking at those options. Of course, the uptake is slow. As I mentioned, there's only 3% of the vehicles which has electric vehicles. So people need to look at it. That might be one option for, you know, young buyers, but it's an expensive proposition. I do understand that. The second option might be if some houses have two cars, right? Two passenger cars or three passenger cars or four or whatever that might be. So at least imagine when you're going to replace your second vehicle or something like that, you know, start seriously think about purchasing an electric vehicle, right? So these might be some of the options which New Zealanders can think of. We have the highest ownership rate in terms of population of passenger cars, right? Which is why that number is there. I think it's 2.3 million or something like that at the top of my head for a 5 million population, right? So that's pretty high, so which basically means people have multiple cars, right? So I think we should seriously start thinking a second vehicle. If someone doesn't have a second vehicle, that's fine, you know. But if they're thinking about a second vehicle or a third vehicle, they should consider, you know, picking up a EV option, right? Or at least explore that option before they commit to purchasing their second vehicle.
That was Professor Nirmal Nair from University of Auckland on whether EVs are a realistic petrol alternative and if our grid is ready for the transition.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat. Text in your thoughts 5395. This is some Marlon Williams.
Hoppe, kiraro. Hoppe, oya ha ha.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
As we covered earlier in the show, petrol prices in New Zealand have climbed over $3 a litre in parts of the country, putting added pressure on households already dealing with the cost of living crisis. New Zealand imports all of its refined fuel, making it particularly exposed to global disruptions. While officials say the country holds about a 50-day fuel reserve, recent price spikes have raised questions about how secure that supply really is. Beyond the pump, rising fuel costs can flow through the wider economy, affecting everything from transport and freight to retail and food prices. I spoke with Dr. Murat Ungo from the University of Otago about what's driving rising petrol prices, how vulnerable New Zealand's fuel system is, and what this means for everyday New Zealanders.
We're now seeing petrol prices climbing past $3 per litre in parts of New Zealand. What does that mean for households already dealing with the cost of living pressures right now?
Since the outbreak of the conflict in the Middle East, global oil and natural gas prices have increased sharply, and which will boost global inflation in the near term. In addition to energy supply disruptions, transportation bottlenecks stemming from the effective closure of the Strait of Hormuz could impact the supply of other commodities such as fertilizer. And everything in New Zealand is moved by truck, So when prices spike, the cost of transporting food, building materials, and consumer goods will increase. So we can expect to see this cost passed on at the supermarket checkout within days, within weeks. Items like fresh produce, which rely on just-in-time delivery, are likely to see price hikes first. There's also a psychological effect. When people see fuel at $3, they often cut back on discretionary spending, such as dining out or weekend trips, which in turn will hurt local businesses.
You've pointed out that New Zealand is fully reliant on imported refined fuel. How exposed does that leave us in situations like these?
Very exposed, extremely exposed, because we are a price taker and we rely heavily on shipping routes from Asia and the Middle East. The war in the Middle East has increased volatility in global energy prices and financial markets, and therefore heighten risks to the global economy. So the breadth and the duration of the conflict, and therefore its economic impact, remain highly uncertain. So if there's any conflict overseas, or a refinery outage in Singapore, or a shipping bottleneck, the price at the pump in Auckland or Invercargill will rise almost immediately. So the reliance means we have very little control over energy security in the short and medium term.
There's been national discussion about fuel supply levels, like the 50-day reserve. From a practical perspective, how secure is New Zealand's fuel supply right now?
The reserve provides a buffer against shipping delays, but not against price spikes. The 50-day reserve is designed to keep the economy running if a shipment is delayed. It prevents us from physically running out of fuel. That aspect of security remains intact in a sense. However, the reserve does not protect us from the cost of fuel. Even if we have fuel in storage, we still pay global market rates to replace it. So while supply may be stable, the financial pressure persists. And in addition to this, to assess whether that buffer is sufficient, I think we can monitor different factors. The first one is whether international supply chains remain open. The second one is whether shipping routes to New Zealand stay clear. The third one is refinery output in the Asia-Pacific region and the rate of domestic fuel consumption. So as we know, New Zealand imports most of its refined fuel from Asia, and many Asian refineries depend heavily on crude oil from the Middle East. So this means disruptions in that region can indirectly and directly affect New Zealand's fuel supply. If these supply chains continue to function normally and demand does not surge due to panic buying, the system can maintain adequate supply.
How do you think high petrol prices will affect New Zealand's move to renewable energy?
So this is a very long-term related question. Even if the transition to renewable energy accelerated tomorrow, most of New Zealand would still depend on petrol and diesel for many years. Road freight, agriculture, construction, aviation, and the majority of vehicles rely on fuels. So replacing a tractor on a remote farm or an entire national truck fleet cannot happen overnight. Yes, we know that while electrical vehicles are becoming more common, fleet turnover is slow, with vehicles typically remaining on the road for 15 to 20 years. So therefore, I am aware of all these discussions, and the transition to renewable energy is essential and already underway to some extent. But we should remember that it's a marathon rather than a sprint. So for at least next decade, petrol and diesel will remain central to New Zealand's transport system and broader economy.
Finally, what should Kiwis be doing to manage rising fuel costs?
We can always come up with some practical ways to fight with the short-term effects. So a couple of things that come to my mind. For example, combining trips. So instead of multiple short journeys where the engine is cold, people can try to complete errands in one efficient loop. So this can be one practical advice. Another one is that apps like Gaspy are especially useful right now. Prices can vary by as much as 20, 30 cents between suburbs, and using discount tickets can save a few dollars per tank. So searching is going to be another practical advice that I can provide. And perhaps people can consider alternatives such as, if possible, where possible, carpool with colleagues, or incorporate public transport, and perhaps cycling using bicycles, or just walking whenever you have a nice day. For example, we have a nice day in Dunedin right now, so you can walk or you can use cycling for a couple of days of a work week to reduce weekly fuel expenses. So such practical advice can be very effective in the short run.
And what would you like to say to New Zealanders on their instinct to panic buy in this crisis?
It shouldn't be. There is absolutely no reason for panic buying, because panic buying can distort the markets, and all the communication coming from the government and coming from the private sector say that there is absolutely no reason for panic buying. So what I can suggest is that we should always stick to our rational purchasing strategy, and because panic buying and also can cause unnecessary spending and unnecessary behavior change, and there's absolutely no reason for panic buying at this stage.
That was Dr. Mura Ungua from the University of Otago on rising petrol prices.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1-4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.